From around the Beltway to around the world, news, talk, and conversation. 96.3 WHUR Washington and HUR Voices Sirius XM Channel 141 present The Daily Drum with Harold Fisher.
Good evening. This is a special edition of The Daily Drum for Thursday, August 23rd. I'm Harold Fisher. We hear a lot these days about good and bad police officers, from deadly encounters with unarmed black men to selfless acts of kindness for strangers. But these stories are often told from the outside, from news outlets, or even short interviews with officers who are often reserved in their descriptions of what they are willing or allowed to share. Well, what is the real, unvarnished, and transparent story of modern policing? And how do officers view race, brutality, corruption, as well as the serve and protect pledge of the job? Well, tonight, we're hearing an insider's story. My guests are Matthew Horace, a former police officer, and Ron Harris, a former news reporter. They are co-authors of the new book, The Black and Blue, A Cop Reveals Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement. We want our listeners to know this is a previously recorded edition of The Daily Drum. We are not taking phone calls tonight. Matthew, Ron, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Matthew, why write this book?
Well, you know, it was becoming very clear as I was providing commentary for CNN day after day and week after week that the shooting and the killing of black men by police over the last several years was more than just an anomaly or a one-off or a few bad apples. And as we started to see things develop, I thought that I should use my platform to sort of tell my own individual story and the story of other officers and agents in terms of what we see behind the blue line and why the public is now seeing what we've known for many years.
But you make an interesting point, because you start, as you said, you were talking about being a contributor for CNN, but you were a police officer for much longer. Didn't you not see that this was an issue when you were an officer?
Well, I did see, and you were exposed to those incidents of racism or implicit bias or unconscious bias. But what has changed now is that when you're working in a department in Arlington or D.C. or Fairfax, I wasn't exposed to what was happening all around the country, with the exception of when I got a chance to meet other police officers and other federal agents. Now, because of video technology, we are now seeing much more than we've ever seen in the past, and it's becoming very real, and, you know, it's very visceral. So I decided now was the right time to sort of tell my story and the story of others.
Talk to me about the title, The Black and the Blue, A Cop Reveals the Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement.
Well, you know, we went round and round about what the book should be called. But, you know, at the end of the day, I'm African-American, and I've also been on the other side being blue. And like I've said on many interviews over the last week, you're never quite black enough and you're never quite blue enough.
What do you mean by that?
Well, you represent something that represents years of injustices in the eyes of many. So you're trying to elicit support and cooperation from citizens when you're in uniform or as a federal agent, not in uniform. But then you go to work each and every day, and you're trying to be a part of this blue brotherhood and do what you need to do to survive in that arena. And sometimes it can be very stressful navigating both.
Ron, you're not a police officer.
That's true.
What did you bring in collaborating with Matthew to this book project? Was there a point or a time when there were things that you struggled with as a non-police officer that he shared with you?
Well, you know, it's funny. I've been covering this issue for years. As a journalist, I remember the very first story I did for a little newspaper down in Memphis, Tennessee, was a police shooting of an elderly black woman. And in the old days, the way the story worked was the police would say this woman was approaching us, she had a knife, and we had no option but to shoot her. What many black journalists did in those cases, we talked to other people, and we introduced the other side of the story. But even back then, as a journalist, and we covered this stuff extensively, it was always difficult to get all of those stories in because the public's always sided with the police. So if you guy called you up and he said, look, I just got beaten savagely by police. You could see the bruises. You could see the broken arms. Unless you had video, which we now have, and I think Matt mentioned that, people were always going to say, well, he must have done something for the police to have to do that. Mm-hmm. And so we struggle with trying to get that story told. The other side of that is that, you know, for years as a reporter with the Los Angeles Times and other news agencies, I covered cops and I covered the juvenile justice, criminal justice. Back in the 90s, I did one of the early stories about the drug war, in which I pointed out that the drug war, even though it was actually white Americans who were doing all the drug, most of the drugs, 80% of the drugs, who were selling 80% of the drugs, it was black people who were going to jail. So that the war on drugs actually became a war on black people. Not necessarily by design, but that's the way that that worked. So it's always been a subject that I've been watching. It's been close to my sort of wheelhouse in terms of what you want to do as a journalist.
And from your perspective, in covering police in different parts of the country, sheriff's departments, city police departments, suburban police departments, are there some similarities that were the same no matter where you went?
And we talk about that in the book. That's one of the things that we talk about in the book in great detail, in that, unfortunately, and Matt saw this as an officer, in the world of policing, whether it's sheriff department, whatever department, there's a culture that says, I have to be loyal to my fellow police officers before I am loyal to the people who I am called on to protect and serve. These are the people who pay me. And because of that, as Matt talks about the blue line, that no matter what you do, we have bad police officers, we have malevolent police officers, we have just inept police officers. But we're going to protect those guys at all costs. And we saw that. We covered that. We went to Chicago. We saw that. We saw that in Los Angeles, in New York.
In Missouri.
In Missouri. We saw it everywhere, that this systemic problem of police officers and law enforcement, particularly on those lower levels, of saying no matter what happens, we're going to life our brother officers. And one of the cases, and I'll just bring this up quickly, and Matt, I think, will agree with me, one of the worst cases was in Chicago. We saw a case, and this is the shooting of Laquan McDonald. Mm-hmm. A police officer shot Laquan McDonald, 17-year-old boy, shot him 16 times. He claimed that he lunged at him. There was video of all this going on. Three other officers lied on their police reports and said, yes, he did, even though they knew that there was video of the incident that didn't show that.
Yeah.
Because they had to be protecting and lining up with the brotherhood instead of saying, wait a minute, that's not what happened. This guy was rogue. No. We don't want him in the department. We need to be, our first loyalty comes to the people who we are paid to protect.
Well, we're very much, you know, our culture is one that says sort of band up, line up, put your feet in the ground and be loyal. And we just do that. You see this even after the video last week in Baltimore with what happened with the officer there.
Right. The officer in Baltimore who was caught severely beating a man on the street, his partner also now under scrutiny because he did not attempt to break it up, according to what we've seen.
Well, this is what you have. As soon as that happened, and I'm on a lot of the different social media sites, and you had officers immediately saying, here, we're under attack again, right? You don't know what happened before the video. You don't know what happened after the video. Well, why does it take all that information for intelligent people to look at something and say, this is wrong? This book is in no way an indictment on policing. It's an indictment on bad policing. And I think if you talk to people in the community, they make that distinction. Look, we need police officers, but we don't need the kind of officers that you saw in Baltimore. And the officer who stood by idly by and doing nothing is just as complicit in the problem.
Tonight we're hearing an insider story about the police, about race, brutality, corruption, as well as the Serve and Protect Pledge of the Job. My guests are Matthew Horace. He is a former police officer, also a former ATF agent, also Ron Harris, a former news reporter. They are the co-authors of the new book, The Black and the Blue, A Cop Reveals Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement. Now, this is a previously recorded edition of The Daily Drum. We are not taking phone calls tonight. Matthew, why did you become an officer, a police officer?
Well, you know, it's an interesting story. Given what I saw, I grew up in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I was exposed to the different police issues that were happening at the time in Philadelphia. And while I was a matriculating NCAA student at Delaware State University, I was home one summer, and I was actually viciously attacked by a Philadelphia canine officer during a parade. And this was my first experience in terms of dealing with the police directly. And when we learned, when my parents went and got reports about the incident, we learned that the officers who took me to the hospital put in their reports that they didn't know the nature of my injuries, that they didn't know how I had sustained those injuries, and they also referred to me as a suspect in that report. Although I was never arrested, I was never charged or anything. But that kind of like got me into this, wow, this is what policing is really about, and this is what people will do to protect each other. Keep in mind, in this situation, the officers who took me to the hospital didn't even know the canine officer, but they still decided to stick to their story, and look, I don't know what happened to him. While I was in college, police department started recruiting, and naturally a lot of athletes sort of gravitated towards policing. There's that aspect of the physicality, the nobility of serving, and those sorts of things. So I applied to a couple of different departments and got hired on right here in the nation's capital in Arlington, Virginia.
After you became an officer, when was your first experience, what was your first experience, I should say, that gave you pause as related to what you pledged to do, protect and serve, and having to address the blue line, the blue wall, issues of integrity?
Well, I think a couple times during my rookie year, my second year on the department, you know, you have these calls where you start to see that officers speak to people differently in different communities, and officers have a little less patience in some situations they do in other situations. And, you know, at any given point, we, all of us in the profession, we've had to grab people and pull them to the side and say, hey, listen, what you just said and what you just did was inappropriate. If it happens again, I'm going to go to a supervisor. I remember once over in Arlington, I went to a whole group of supervisors about a white officer who was he arrested a gentleman who was making a complaint and being really passionate about his complaint. And he wasn't getting his questions answered. And the officer arrested him and put him in handcuffs for disorderly conduct. And I had to go to the supervisors over there and say, look, this was inappropriate. I don't appreciate it. But then there was those times when you're working with people. And I had a time when I was with ATF where an agent used the M-word when referring to some African-Americans. And you can't just think that those are anomalies. It's just an anomaly because you're present. So I realized it, you know, early on that there is this division. And, you know, some people, even in the best police departments, can't get away from their implicit biases and even overt racisms.
I'm going to talk about something that Ron mentioned earlier, but I want to go back a little bit. What was your experience with fellow officers during the release of the Rodney King video in 1991? Because as Ron was saying, now police officers have body cams, they have dash cams, and arguably it has changed not only the way that police officers do their jobs, it has changed the way that the community has access to information and the like. But prior to 1991 and the Rodney King incident, there was no such thing. How did that change things among the rank and file in your opinion?
Well, it's interesting because I remember when that happened. I remember talking about that incident in the squad rooms and the squad bays. And at the time, no one disagreed that incident was abhorrent. No one disagreed, but they really didn't want to address the real core issue, because many of the people who disagreed held the same beliefs in terms of those implicit biases that we all have. But I remember gearing up with the special response team because we were being sent to Los Angeles as a result. And people were so focused on the criminality that was going on at the time that they lost their focus on what had caused this. But what I will say is this. Video has been a game changer for me in one respect, and that is now the world is seeing what other people in other communities have seen for decades.
I have to really agree with that. I was in Los Angeles working at the LA Times when that video came out. And for African-American journalists and for the African-American community, we were saying, finally.
I told you so.
We've been telling you this forever and ever and ever and ever. And from that point, when a person said, yes, there is police brutality, then there's a little bit more traction there, you know, than before. Because before it would be dismissed. Certain things, I was in Los Angeles, we had the Chief Daryl Gates, and we were having a lot of black African Americans who were being the famous, infamous chokehold. And one time, one of my co-workers was, he interviewed Daryl Gates about something else. They talked about the chokehold. And until he listened to the tape, it's when Daryl Gates made the famous statement, well, you know, normal people don't die when we put a chokehold on them. And it was, you could see the racism, you could see the otherness in all that process. And I agree with Matt 100%. If it weren't for, I think video citizens with video cameras, body cameras, have been a game changer, without question. That officer, for instance, in Baltimore, that officer had accosted that same man a month earlier.
Right.
And had arrested that same man. And he was harassing him. That's really what it was. And now, in that earlier incident, and people talked about the earlier incident, there was no video. This time he got caught.
Tonight we are having a chance to speak about an insider story about police, race, brutality, corruption, and serving and protecting. Matthew Horace is a former police officer and ATF agent. Ron Harris is a former news reporter. They worked on the new book, The Black and the Blue, A Cop Reveals Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement. We want to remind our listeners that this is a previously recorded edition of The Daily Drum. We are not taking phone calls tonight. To the point about brutality, let's talk a little bit about brutality, Matthew. I don't think there is anyone, whether they thrive in the underworld or they are law-abiding citizens, who would disagree with the statement, policing is hard. It is very difficult. And daily, and sometimes I would argue hourly, you deal with at best difficult people, sometimes dangerous people, sometimes extremely dangerous people. How do you balance that work, that shifting dynamic of law-abiding to very dangerous, to law-abiding to semi-dangerous, to sneaky, to law-abiding, hour by hour by hour?
It's a great question. But you know what? I can't help but to think about one quote that came in Chief Phil Banks from New York City Police Department. We were talking about the difficulty in law enforcement. It is very difficult. And what Phil says, and what we say in the book is this. Everyone knows that policing is difficult. What people don't understand is, why is it that police are never wrong?
Tell me about that.
Well, when you look at the different cases that come up time after time after time, there always seems to be a pro and a con. We all know what the differences are between right and wrong, but for whatever reason, before we didn't used to see video, but now we see video. In doing the research for the book, Ron and I both spoke to hundreds of people. And I even spoke to dozens, if not more, of my friends, both black and white. But there's a unique phenomenon. A lot of the white folks that we speak to, if there isn't video to validate what you're saying, they still don't believe that it happened. And if you take the Walter Scott case and the fact that he got shot in the back running away.
Mm-hmm. In South Carolina. Yeah.
When you speak to people, they will tell you, had I not seen video, I would not have even believed that what someone was saying was true. Now, why is it that so many people can believe that could happen, and there are so many people that wouldn't believe it could happen until they saw a video?
One would argue that historically police officers have meant different things to different communities.
Well, but the other side of that is this. We live in a much more integrated society, particularly on a professional level. And when your professional coworkers, when you tell them, and they know you, these are things that happen. You tell your white coworkers, these are things that happen. They happen to me, they happen to Matt, they happen to kids in the neighborhood. And they say, Ron, they look at you and they just like, that couldn't happen. Now, it's almost like, wait a minute, you know me. You know, I talk to you every day. I don't make up stuff. We depend on each other. You depend on my veracity. You depend on my intelligence. You depend on my truthfulness. And why is it when I tell you that this happens with police and African Americans, you don't believe that?
So what is the reason? Because as I mentioned, the experiences of different cultures, of different races as it relates, and sometimes you could even argue different socioeconomic status would suggest that the experiences with police different from situation to situation.
I got you. I hear that, but here's the other side of that coin that I kind of use. The Me Too movement is an example. I don't know, if you ask me about my personal family, do I have a lot of family members who can say, no, I was sexually harassed? I don't have a lot of experience in that. Do I believe it when women say that? Yes, I do. And I have no reason not to believe that. And that's what we as a country sort of say. You know, we believe that happens. And so the question is, if you believe that happens, and we believe that to the degree that heads of major corporations have been dismissed, major movie moguls, directors, really important people with stature are being dismissed, then why can't you believe that when Matt tells you or when you tell somebody, this does happen, and I can tell you it happens, what makes that so hard to believe?
Well, even in the book, we talk about Tim Scott down in South Carolina, a staunch Republican, right? He's in South Carolina. Even in his own district, he has been stopped. Mm-hmm. Not once, not twice, but dozens of times.
Suffice it to say, that happened to him on Capitol Hill as a freshman senator when he was stopped by the Capitol Hill police because he did not have his Senate pin on,
right,
and no one knew who he was.
Right. And the one thing we learned, and the one thing I learned in law enforcement, when you get together with your colleagues from around the country in different states and cities and locations, even foreign locations, and you start talking about your experience and listening to theirs, we're all having the same experiences. So again, you go back to being black and blue. When we get together, we find out, yeah, I was stopped when I was on the road, and let me tell you what this officer did. Or I got stopped, and a guy pulled me out with a gun, and I told him I had a gun. You hear these stories over and over. So the problems, the challenges are more overwhelming than I think what the public wants to recognize, even in the video digital age. They're seeing it, but when Wall Street, when lawyers, when judges can tell you the same things, when are people going to start listening? Mm-hmm. We do have these issues.
To that point, there is a scene in the new movie Black Klansman, Spike Lee's movie, and forgive the spoiler if you haven't seen it, where the main character, the black officer in the Colorado Springs Police Department, and one could also argue that Colorado Springs remains not certainly as white as it was during the 1970s, but it's not the D.C. or L.A. or New York City police department. But in the movie, there is a scene where he says, I'm a police officer. And even when he tells the officer, when the officer asks, where's your badge? It's in my pocket. Instead of reaching, because he's already covered with a gun by the second officer, he still gets a billy club in the gut.
Right. I saw the movie, and, you know, it made me think. And in the book, I tell an experience about when I was doing an undercover operation, and I was buying narcotics and guns from a suspect. And the suspect was Hispanic and 5'9". I am the undercover.
5'9"?
5'9".
Oh, 5'9".
5'9".
Okay, go ahead.
All right, that suspect. I'm 6'2 and 260, right? when the deal was over, I'm walking away from the operation. Some officers who were not even involved with the operation drew down on me and started demanding that I get on the ground. For whatever reason, they presumed I was a part of the bad guys or a part of this deal. And these have tragic consequences because Omar Edwards in New York was an African-American police officer, and that's all he ever wanted to be his entire life. He located someone trying to steal his car.
Hold that point, because I want you to pick that up on the other side. I've got to take a really quick break. And for our listeners, please stay with us, because the Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with the original Quiet Storm on 96.3 WHUR. This conversation about the black and the blue will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141 in just a few seconds.
Our voices, Washington.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we're hearing an insider story about police, race, brutality, corruption, and serving and protecting, that pledge of the job. My guests are Matthew Horace, a former police officer and ATF agent, and Ron Harris, a former news reporter. They are co-authors of the new book, The Black and the Blue, A Cop Reveals Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement. We want to remind our listeners this is a previously recorded edition of The Daily Drum, and we are not taking calls tonight. Before the break, Matthew, you were talking about being black and a police officer and dealing with the situations when your fellow officers that are not black may not necessarily be as, can I say, supportive of you during the course of your police work. Finish your point.
So that's that internal, yes. So there's that internal struggle of trying to fit in where you should be inside the profession. But then think of this. Omar Edwards was a New York City police officer. And all he ever wanted to be his entire life was a New York City police officer. He was African-American. Omar Edwards left the precinct and found somebody breaking into his own vehicle and did what most any cop I know would do and chased after the suspect. When he caught up to the suspect, gun drawn, trying to effect an arrest, he was shot and killed by two New York City police officers in a case of mistaken identity. Well, at the end of the day, and I'm not going to second guess there why they did it, how they got there. But we know when we're out here with guns and badges on that we have to behave in a certain way. And you got to always be mindful that people may not assume that you're a cop right off the bat. And there's case after case after case where people have been shot and killed because no one knew who they were. They didn't stop for one second to think that this person might have been a police officer. And it wasn't until they went up to administer first aid that they found his badge and his shirt that they realized what a disastrous mistake they'd have made.
And Harold, that even goes to even beyond being a police officer. It's funny, I was watching a play the other day, and one of the characters said, one of the worst things you can say is a black man with a gun. He said, somebody's going to get shot. And we have seen that over and over again. In fact, Matt told me a story that about how Matt, you might want to tell this story.
Yeah,
you
went into the I lived in suburban Pennsylvania, and I went into a hardware store, and I saw a white gentleman, and he was cleanly dressed and everything, and he had a gun in a holster in a hardware store. And it was amazing to me that visual created no tension for anyone in the store. Now, I presumed, whether right or wrong, that he was probably a police officer. But we've seen cases where a black man with a holster or a black man with a gun elicits a very different response. And I can tell you this, and I say this in the book, in 28 years, I have never worn an uncovered firearm in a public establishment, because I've always understood that when that police call goes out, right, it very well might go out as black man with a gun. And no one might not say he has a holster on, he has on Dockers and loafers and a tennis sweater, but black man with a gun will get a different response from police.
And that's what happened in the case of 12-year-old Tamir Rice, and that's what happened in the case of John Crawford, who was walking around inside of
a Walmart, I think it was
Beaver Falls,
Ohio,
and doing nothing. And somebody called 911 and said, there's a black guy with a gun. He was walking around that store with a toy gun. that he picked up and just, he was on the phone. He was just idly walking through the store and just chatting on the phone. Next thing you know, he was dead.
What was the most difficult time or most disturbing incident during your career as an officer or ATF agent?
Well, I think when I think back to the war on drugs and I think to what we were doing, and literally we were knocking down doors day in and day out in different cities across America. And, you know, while we believed we were doing the right thing at the time because we're supporting the initiatives of the administrations, seeing those children in those conditions in crack houses and drug houses with guns and money, you know, it was pretty difficult. But then anytime somebody dies, and I think about going to those funerals of law enforcement officers, which are all they're gut-wrenching because all of us understand the sacrifice we make day in and day out. And I never lost sight of that. And that's why in the book, we don't just characterize this as a black-white thing. We characterize it as a black-blue thing. When one of us dies, I hurt. Right. And it doesn't matter what race you are. And the interesting thing, as I explained to Ron along the way, it's very interesting. In one sense, you're a part of the blue code and people die and you cry. In another sense, you're not quite enough a part of the blue code because you risk being compromised both in our organizations. And then when something happens and your opinion differs from others, there is that don't tell on other cops rule. I remember when I came in the police department, just like most of us. The first thing your FTO, field training officer, tells you is what happens in this car stays in this car. But if you really think about it, if you're doing the right thing, why does it matter? And then you fast forward to Baltimore, right, last week, and you look at the other officer standing there. When he didn't break it up. He didn't try to stop him. I would love to see what those reports said when they got back to the station and wrote what had happened. And I'm sure understanding that will give us some insight as to why the officers resigned and why the other ones won suspension.
You know, and one of the things, you know, we keep talking about sort of some of the negatives, but we saw some very positive changes in police departments. We saw some things in New Orleans. New Orleans was really,
New Orleans was one of the most notorious police departments during the 1980s, 1990s.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, all the way up to 2000. Now they've got a new police chief who's come in. And he's, you know, he's trying to change the culture. We saw some interesting things up in Seattle. I mean, it's not that these departments don't have problems, but we have police chiefs who are sending a new message. Same thing, we saw, met an officer. He is, I think, the only openly gay police chief that we know. He kind of cleaned up Richmond, California, which was predominantly black. He was so well-liked. In that city, they hated to see him go. This is a white, is a openly gay police chief. It's funny when they had a Black Lives Matters march in that place. He held up a Black Lives Matter sign because he agreed Black lives do matter. And in fact, it's just a different approach to policing and saying we are going to join with the police department with the community. And you're seeing police chiefs who are understanding it. I'm not the police chief for the police department. I'm the police chief for the city. Mm-hmm. And so I am just as responsible to the citizens as I am to the officers. And I'm more responsible to the citizens because I'm the police chief of Washington, D.C., and not just a police in Washington, D.C.
You know, I think it bears also understanding that this is not just a local problem because having been a federal agent for 24 and a half years, if you really look at it, almost each one of the federal law enforcement organizations had also had their own individual black agent suits. And in each case, the agency's lost. So while we're dealing with the internal struggles of navigating these politically sensitive environments, we're also going out on the streets and being committed to wearing the badge and the gun and doing, you know, what we're designed to do.
When you talk about corruption, what has been your experience with that as you served as either on at a local police department or in the federal service?
Well, I really haven't been exposed to any of these cases that you read about in New Orleans or L.A. or in New York. I've never been around anyone that ever did anything that caused me to pause in terms of corruption. Most of the things I've seen had to do with, you know, excessive use of force or language, you know, using racial slurs and things like that, which my colleagues say that they have the same experiences that I have. And but if you're going to hear those things in the workplace, there's no way that someone can tell me that those behaviors aren't manifested in the way people treat people when they're out on the streets.
One thing I'd like to interject is that Matt touched on this. This is really, while race is a part of it and it's a big part of it, this goes way beyond race. And I want you to look at Baltimore for a minute. In Baltimore, where that police officer beat a black man, put him in the hospital, that police officer was black. His partner was black. The police chief is black. The previous police commissioner was black. When Freddie Gray died in the back of a police van, that police commissioner was black. In fact, even before them, there were 6 African-American police commissioners, and 42% of the police department is black. Similar situation in Philadelphia when Starbucks, the police chief was black. So what we're trying to get at it a little bit here is not as much, while race is part of the problem, particularly when you look at who the victim is, but the biggest issue is the culture.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because you could argue that, you know, corruption, you hear this in, you know, police dramas all the time, being on the pad, taking money and things like that. But is corruption the same as bad culture? Or is that a distinction without a difference?
I don't think so. Only from the standpoint that you are corrupt when you are harassing communities, when you are victimizing communities, and it leads to a different kind of corruption, as we saw in Baltimore,
right?
Because you're behind that blue line. In other words, if you're behind that blue line and you can go out and harass individuals and do certain kinds of things, as in Baltimore, we saw a gang of cops who were planting evidence, who was robbing residents, who were cheating taxpayers out of their money by padding their overtime. So that's just a different level
of corruption. Yeah, because some pieces of corruption, some issues related to corruption are prosecutable offenses.
Right.
And then you have issues of bad culture, maybe a lower level of corruption that are administratively issues that where discipline needs to be applied, if not firing.
Sure.
Well, in some cases,
it's both.
And it's right, exactly right. In the case in Baltimore, that officer resigned to escape punishment, but they're charging him with first and second degree assault.
Right. Okay.
And one of the big challenges that police leaders have, you know, I'm a member of NOBLE, the ICP, and the other leadership organizations. To come in and be a change agent, we have a saying we always say that culture eats strategy for lunch. So the greatest change agents in any discipline, whether it be academia or policing, they are people that can turn a ship from one direction to another. We have a very strong, intense culture in policing. And some police leaders have been successful at doing it, and some have failed at doing it. Because a lot of times the troops look at it like, this chief is only going to be here for 2 or 3 years. How do you change years of bad habits? So it gets beyond, like Ron said, it gets beyond just corruption. Years of bad habits that have been left unchecked.
So how do you do that? Because as we've seen recently in the murder of Micaiah Wilson, D.C. Police Chief Peter Newsom has spoken publicly as well as, I should say, in the community as well as on this program about the difficulty of getting communities to come forward when they have information, when those communities have been wronged by others in the community, when you've had members of your community kill someone, innocent people in your community, you know who it is. And the only way that the police are going to be able to figure this out is if you tell us, if you give us clues, if you tell us who it is, and yet people are afraid, their snitches get stitches, and all of these other kinds of things. How do you break that cycle and change community culture so that they can cooperate with
people? Well, we heard some really good things in the writing of the book and speaking to people. But at the end of the day, if there's a lack of trust, no one's going to talk to police. And if you look at Chicago, for instance, Chicago has the lowest clearance rate for homicides of any major city in the United States. And in some years, they've had the highest murder rate. So ultimately, you have more people that have committed more murders walking around amongst us. So you have more people who know the people that are walking around, but they're not coming forward. So if it's fear or trust, it's something that we have to work to improve upon. Because if you don't get information, you can't solve crimes.
One of the people we talked to while we were there was Father Flegler. Father Michael Flegler, he's a huge advocate. You know, you're familiar
yes.
with him.
Yes, he's been on this program.
He said something interesting to us. He said, Ron, Matt, people don't tell important information. They don't get that important information to people they don't trust. And I thought about that for a minute. No matter what the secret is, if I don't trust you, I'm not going to give you that information. And that is really, as Matt pointed out, that's the biggest problem in Chicago. Their problem is an issue of trust, an issue of a relationship between the community and the police. People don't trust the police. They don't trust them with the information. They don't trust if they tell them that it's not going to come back to them. They don't trust what police are going to do with the information. It's just really an issue of trust.
We are talking to Ron Harris and Matthew Horace, co-authors of the new book, The Black and the Blue, A Cop Reveals Crimes, Racism, and Injustice in America's Law Enforcement. This is an insider story about police, race, brutality, corruption, and the serve and protect pledge on that job. In the book, Matthew, you talk about David Lomax, a former ATF agent. Talk to me about him.
Yeah, David Lomax was a very good friend and colleague. He was on the job with me with ATF, but David Lomax was a St. Louis police officer prior to coming on the job with ATF. We thought it was important to get a perspective of someone who understood the dynamics and the nuances of St. Louis and St. Louis County. And David Lomax told us that when he was a police officer with St. Louis Police, he got called to a woman's house on a call for service. And when he showed up at the call, the woman said to him, I called the police. I didn't call for two M words. And this wasn't that long ago. This was in the early 80s. So in my mind, it wasn't that long ago. Certainly long enough that should not have been a part of any dialogue anywhere. But just to give you some, you know, backdrop of what happens. And on another call, he was on a call for service with a white officer who got assaulted by a black man after the officer called someone in his car the M-word. And that creates that separation, what you were asking about earlier. He knew that what the officer did was wrong, but then he was put in a position to have to arrest someone for assaulting the officer. And that's a part of that strange dichotomy that we live with, having to see things develop that had it not been for the officer's actions, we would not have been placed into action.
You mentioned St. Louis, Missouri, St. Louis County. What went wrong in Ferguson from your perspective?
Well, let me dive into that one because yeah. And that is the key issue across America. Matt and I talked about this. Police do not operate in a vacuum. They don't even set their own targets and rules. Someone above them says, this is what we want you to do. It's kind of like the military to some degree. The military is sort of like a loaded gun. Whatever you point them, that's where they're going to go. And in Ferguson, that whole situation started with a city manager. They hired in a new city manager, and he said, well, if you want me to raise money to fix downtown, let's start giving out a lot more tickets. And who are you going to give them to? You can give them to the people who are least likely to have the money to pay them, so that way we can stack on more tickets and more tickets. He then hired in a new police chief. That police chief is the one he wanted to go out and institute that policy. He made sure he had a city attorney, a woman that was also going to – they really formed a team. And it was about
money,
taxing people for money. The police department was the tool that they used. So whether you liked it, that was your job. In fact, they even held sessions and says, okay, now when you stop someone for speeding, you got to give them more than one ticket. Look on the car. Give them a ticket for the windshield wipers. Give him a ticket for the registration. Give him a ticket for everything that they could. In fact, one officer had gotten it up that he could give 12 tickets. And in the process, they ruined lives. The shooting of Michael Brown was kind of the culmination of years of abuse. We talk about it in the book. There was a young man named Fred Watson. His life was just virtually destroyed. He was making six figures. He had a high-level security clearance. He was a young man. He got kids in private school. They took that young man through the ringer because he was sitting in the park watching people play baseball. And they stopped him, and they gave him eight tickets. And none of them were true. They gave him a ticket for not having a driver's license, even though he had one. They gave him a ticket for not having a registration, even though it was right there in the car. They gave him tickets for window tint, which was legal. But because of all of that, he lost his security clearance because he couldn't clear that case. And when he lost that security clearance,
he lost his job. Yeah.
And then the case got thrown out.
But now, I mean,
his life has completely changed.
He was not the only one. That happened to many, many residents that we talked to in that area. And so, as I said, Michael Brown was a culmination of a lot of pain and suffering in that community. And it didn't start out with police. It started out with city managers. And that's true about these police departments. One of the things that I just like to say is we focus too much on the police department. And what we should be focusing on is the people who are really in charge of the police department. And who are those? Those are the mayors. Those are our city councilmen. Those are the people who have the jurisdiction to say, when we tell them we want to be policed this way, then it's their job to go and make sure that happens.
But we often hear activists remind voters that, and we heard this in Ferguson. I would argue that we even heard this in Gina, Louisiana. Mm. During the Gina 6 controversy way back in 2008, that if you want to see change in police departments, sheriff's departments, because let us be clear, police are often they operate in cities and counties that are part of urban communities.
Right.
But particularly in the South and in the West, in rural communities, the highest ranking elected official in any county may not be a county commissioner or executive, but may be the sheriff.
Sure.
And so we hear activists say, if you want to see change, exercise your right to vote. But people don't seem to always understand that, no matter how often they hear that.
Right. Well, if you look at it, and we didn't put this in the book, but it's very relevant. Look at what happened in East Pittsburgh a couple weeks ago with the young man who was shot in the back. The officer was ultimately charged and fired. That goes back to a policy issue. Now, the officer had worked for three different police departments. He had been sworn in 4 hours before this shooting,
right. Put
in a police car and asked to go patrol communities that he was unfamiliar with. Is that the officer's fault, or is that the policy and the government and the organization's fault? He didn't hire himself. He applied for a job, but someone thought he was qualified to have that position. But people protested his house. They didn't protest City Hall, the police chief, the mayor. And I think what Ron's saying is this book is as much about policy as it is about conduct.
Let's talk a little bit about the other side of policing that we often don't hear about. It's the stuff that doesn't make it to video, the stuff that doesn't necessarily make it to the news, but we always hear one bad apple spoils the whole bunch, and not all police officers, or 90% of police officers, you know, are good. From your perspective, Matthew, what good were you able to do when you were an officer, either ATF or in local police departments?
Well, I think I answer that in several ways. Number one, I was able to change the hearts and minds of people in different cases, where I was able to convince people, no matter what your walk of life, that I was there to help and support what you were doing. And that goes beyond just being in a shootout or a chase or arresting some really bad people for armed robbery or drug trafficking. And the other thing I was able to do was provide opportunities for people to get on the job, because you can't be a part of the problem. You have to be a part of the solution. And that happens by bringing people along behind you.
Back to the community piece, give me an example of how you positively impacted a community or individual. Tell me a story.
Well, the only thing I can think of is that by being involved with Noble and getting out there and doing those backpack drives and explorers conferences and law enforcement appreciation events where we bring in kids to see, when you do search warrants in a community and the public comes out and claps because they thank you. There's been those times in Baltimore and Philadelphia or Boston, and we've done operations in communities, and community members who look like my mother or father came out and thanked us and clapped and said, thank God you all came, because we were in jail on our own. And that made me think back to growing up in Philadelphia and what my parents were going through on their own block and their own communities. So those were always heartwarming. And they happen more often than you would realize. The challenge is that many years later, these communities are back to where they were before.
Hmm. Well, I think Matt's, he's being a little humble in that he's not talking about a situation in Newark. You want to talk
about that? Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I forgot about that. In Newark, New Jersey, when I was a special agent in charge, I was exposed to the murder of three Delaware State University students who were killed in a gang initiation shooting in Newark. They were all members of the band. You know how important bands are to HBCUs. And I learned about that when I was in Denver, Colorado. And when I was in Newark, we were shown the autopsy photographs as a part of a leadership meeting of those students.
At this point, he was the agent in charge.
I was agent in charge mm-hmm. in Newark. And I never lost – I can still see those young people's faces today that were on the – and it dawned on me that they, like me, had grown up in an urban environment. They had hopes for the future. It dawned on me how connected we were. They were in the band. I played football.
At Delaware State.
Yes. Right? So this was my alumni. And it dawned on me that these were three people whose hopes would never see fruition. The community was heartbroken. They were devastated. And these were three great kids. And as a result of that, I started the Horace Foundation for Criminal Justice Studies at Delaware State University to try to give students in northern New Jersey an opportunity to be a part of the solution and not a part of the problem. So I never lost sight of that. I mentioned that in the book. And it's something that still haunts me to this day, how those emerging students died.
Real quick, Ron, because I'm running out of time. From your perspective, covering cops, but now as an observer, what is the best positive change for police departments across the country that make policing in some small way better than it was 20 or 30 years ago?
I think two things. One is police are going to have to reach out to the communities. And the biggest thing is that the communities are also going to reach out to the police. For instance, at every church, just like they have a ministry for the choir and a ministry for youth and a ministry for outreach, they should have a ministry for police. And that church should go out and establish a relationship with the police department. And that at that point that they can, as a police officer told us, you really need to sort of train police in how you want to be policed. And that if you can establish that relationship so that, I'll give you a quick question. For instance, the question is, you picked up my son. Do you want me to take him to the juvenile court, or should I bring him to you? Hmm. Now, I can take him to juvenile court, but if I got that relationship, I know that this is Miss Jones's son. And the worst thing this kid wants me to do is take him back home to mom.
Mm-hmm.
No record. That kind of relationship has to develop between police and communities. And I think it's a two-way street. I think we've seen that in certain communities. We really saw that in Richmond, California. We've seen it in Tucson. So we're seeing certain kinds of things where police departments are much more interactive.
I'm out of time. We could talk about this for another hour, I'm sure. But I want to say congratulations on the book. And it's a great title and great information. An insider's look at policing. So, Matthew Horace, thank you so much for sharing with us. Ron Harris, also good to have you as a partner mm-hmm. in this book effort. So, again, to both of you, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
That is The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141 for this Thursday, August 23rd. I'm Harold Fisher. You can tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Now, stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.
Need some McCarthy?